Cleopatra's newly born child was killed in its mother's arms, and Cleopatra, no doubt after a little taunting, was then strangled. These excesses of womanly feeling are said to have shocked Alexander, but they didn't prevent him from leaving his mother in a position of considerable authority in Macedonia. She wrote letters to him upon religious and political questions, and he showed a dutiful disposition in sending her always a large share of the plunder he made. Third, these stories have to be told because history can't be understood without them. Here was the great world of men between India and the Adriatic, ready for union, ready as it had never been before for a unifying control. Here was the wide order of the Persian Empire with its roads, its posts, its general peace and prosperity, ripe for the fertilizing influence of the Greek mind. And these stories display the quality of the human beings to whom those great opportunities came. Here was this Philip, who was a very great and noble man, and yet he was drunken. He could keep no order in his household. Here was Alexander, in many ways gifted above any man of his time, and he was vain, suspicious, and passionate, with a mind set awry by his mother. We're beginning to understand something of what the world might be, something of what our race might become, were it not for our still raw humanity. It's barely a matter of 70 generations between ourselves and Alexander, and between ourselves and the savage hunters, our ancestors, who charred their food in the embers or ate it raw, intervene some 400 or 500 generations. There's not much scope for the modification of a species in 400 or 500 generations. Make men and women only sufficiently jealous, or fearful, or drunken, or angry, and the hot red eyes of the cavemen will glare out at us today. We've writing and teaching, science and power. We've tamed the beasts and schooled the lightning, but we're still only shambling towards the light. We've tamed and bred the beasts, but we've still to tame and breed ourselves. From the very beginning of his reign, the deeds of Alexander showed how well he had assimilated his father's plans, and how great were his own abilities. A map of the known world is needed to show the course of his life. At first, after receiving assurances from Greece that he was to be captain general of the Grecian forces, he marched through Thrace to the Danube. He crossed the river and burnt a village, the second great monarch to raid the Scythian country beyond the Danube, then recrossed it and marched westward, and so came down by Illyria. By that time, the city of Thebes was in rebellion, and his next blow was at Greece. Thebes, unsupported, of course, by Athens, was taken and looted. It was treated with extravagant violence. All its buildings, except the temple and the house of the poet Pindar, were razed, and 30,000 people sold into slavery. Greece was stunned, and Alexander was free to go on with the Persian campaign. This destruction of Thebes betrayed a streak of violence in the new master of human destinies. It was too heavy a blow to have dealt. It was a barbaric thing to do. If the spirit of rebellion was killed, so also was the spirit of help. The Greek states remained inert thereafter, neither troublesome nor helpful. They wouldn't support Alexander with their shipping, a thing which was to prove a very grave embarrassment to him. There's a story told by Plutarch about this Theban massacre, as if it redounded to the credit of Alexander, but indeed it shows only how his saner and his crazy sides were in conflict. It tells of a Macedonian officer and a Theban lady. This officer was among the looters, and he entered this woman's house, inflicted unspeakable insults and injuries upon her, and at last demanded whether she had gold or silver hidden. She told him all her treasures had been put into the well, conducted him thither, and, as he stooped to peer down, pushed him suddenly in and killed him by throwing great stones upon him. Some allied soldiers came upon this scene and took her forthwith to Alexander for judgment. She defied him, Already the extravagant impulse that had ordered the massacre was upon the wane, and he not only spared her, but had her family and property and freedom restored to her. This Plutarch makes out to be a generosity, but the issue is more complicated than that. It was Alexander who was outraging and plundering and enslaving all Thebes. That poor, crumpled Macedonian brute in the well had been doing only what he'd been told he had full liberty to do. Is a commander first to give cruel orders, and then to forgive and reward those who slay his instruments? This gleam of remorse, at the instance of one woman who was not perhaps wanting in tragic dignity and beauty, is a poor set-off to the murder of a great city. Mixed with the craziness of Olympias in Alexander was the sanity of Philip and the teachings of Aristotle. This Theban business certainly troubled the mind of Alexander. Whenever afterwards he encountered Thebans, he tried to show them special favour. Thebes, to his credit, haunted him. Yet the memory of Thebes didn't save three other great cities from similar brainstorms. Tyre he destroyed, and Gaza, and a city in India, in the storming of which he was knocked down in fair fight and wounded. And of the latter place, not a soul, not a child, was spared. He must have been badly frightened to have taken so evil a revenge. At the outset of the war, the Persians had this supreme advantage. They were practically masters of the sea. The ships of the Athenians and their allies sulked unhelpfully. Alexander, to get at Asia, had to go round by the Hellespont, and if he pushed far into the Persian Empire, he ran the risk of being cut off completely from his base. His first task, therefore, was to cripple the enemy at sea, and this he could only do by marching along the coast of Asia Minor and capturing port after port until the Persian sea bases were destroyed. If the Persians had avoided battle and hung upon his lengthening line of communications, they could probably have destroyed him, but this they didn't do. A Persian army, not very much greater than his own, gave battle on the banks of the Granicus and was destroyed, 334 BC. This left him free to take Sardis, Ephesus, Miletus, and after a fierce struggle, Halicarnassus. Meanwhile, the Persian fleet was on his right flank, and between him and Greece, threatening much but accomplishing nothing. In 333 BC, pursuing this attack upon the sea bases, he marched along the coast as far as the head of the gulf now called the Gulf of Alexandretta. A huge Persian army, under the great king Darius III, was inland of his line of march, separated from the coast by mountains, and Alexander went right beyond this enemy force before he or the Persians realized their proximity. Scouting was evidently very badly done by Greek and Persian alike. The Persian army was a vast, ill-organized assembly of soldiers, transport, camp followers, and so forth. Darius, for instance, was accompanied by his harem, and there was a great multitude of harem slaves, musicians, dancers, and cooks. Many of the leading officers had brought their families to witness the hunting down of the Macedonian invaders. The troops had been levied from every province in the empire. They had no tradition or principle of combined action. Seized by the idea of cutting off Alexander from Greece, Darius moved this multitude over the mountains to the sea. He had the luck to get through the passes without opposition, and he encamped on the plain of Issus between the mountains and the shore. And there Alexander, who had turned back to fight, struck him. The cavalry charge and the phalanx smashed this great brittle host as a stone smashes a bottle. It was routed. Darius escaped from his war chariot, that out-of-date instrument, and fled on horseback, leaving even his harem in the hands of Alexander. All the accounts of Alexander after this battle show him at his best. He was restrained and magnanimous. He treated the Persian princesses with the utmost civility, and he kept his head. He held steadfastly to his plan. He let Darius escape, unpursued, into Syria, and he continued his march upon the naval bases of the Persians, that is to say, upon the Phoenician ports of Tyre and Sidon. Sidon surrendered to him. Tyre resisted. Here, if anywhere, we have the evidence of great military ability on the part of Alexander. His army was his father's creation, but Philip had never shone in the siege of cities. When Alexander was a boy of 16, he had seen his father repulsed by the fortified city of Byzantium upon the Bosphorus. Now he was face to face with an inviolate city which had stood siege after siege, which had resisted Nebuchadnezzar the Great for 14 years. For the standing of sieges, Semitic peoples hold the palm. Tyre was then an island half a mile from the shore, and her fleet was unbeaten. On the other hand, Alexander had already learned much of the siege of the citadel of Halicarnassus. He'd gathered to himself a corps of engineers from Cyprus and Phoenicia. The Sidonian fleet was with him, and presently the king of Cyprus came over to him with 120 ships, which gave him the command of the sea. Moreover, great Carthage, either relying on the strength of the mother city or being disloyal to her, and being furthermore entangled in a war in Sicily, sent no help.